people to feel that there is a real change and an improvement in the humanitarian situation.
Observers say the national delegation will likely reject the renewal of the truce since no progress has been made so far to find a solution regarding paying the government employees whose salaries are suspended since 2016 as a result of the Saudi war on Yemen.
The national delegation was refusing to extend the truce for the third time and did not agree until the mediation of Oman. At the time, an agreement was made regarding the unpaid salaries. Unfortunately, nothing has been achieved so far. Therefore, I think that the national delegation will not agree to extend the truce for a fourth time until radical solutions are found regarding the salaries.
The Security Council highlighted the tangible benefits of the UN-brokered truce to the Yemeni people, including the flow of fuel through Hodeidah port. However, the Yemeni Petroleum Company says Saudi Arabia is still imposing restrictions on fuel imports.
Yemenis say the Saudi-led coalition has not fulfilled its commitments under the UN agreement over the past months. Therefore, the national delegation says it will continue the talks only to reach a solution that completely ends the war and siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Life is not yet hectic in central Berlin on an end of summer Monday. As Berliners gradually return to work, for many it is difficult not to turn on to the energy issues afflicting the country. The recent announcement by Russia to halt gas deliveries to Germany via the key pipeline Nord Stream 1 for an indefinite period has sparked fears of power shortages next winter and fueled inflation.
Also, natürlich bin ich besorgt.
Of course I'm worried. The energy crisis is a pressing issue for all Germans. We're moving back to coal-powered plants, and just some of our nuclear power plants are likely to be kept online. And the soaring price of energy, how could I not be worried?
Germany has been trying to reduce its natural gas usage by 20% to avoid an energy shortage this winter. Some large cities in the countries are limiting heating and turning off gas lights to save on natural gas. Germany has decided to replace all Russian energy imports, most notably natural gas, by as soon as the end of 2024. Moscow accounted for 55% of Berlin's gas imports in 2021, a level that declined to 26% by the end of June. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has so far met this gas challenge through a combination of measures, including diversified sources of LNG imports and subsidies.
Can Germany then completely avoid Russian gas? That's an important question. And that depends on several factors. The major factor is the ability of the states to provide LNG to Germany. And also the ability and the interest of Germany to subscribe contracts that are long-term contracts, 10-year contracts for LNG supply.
Meanwhile, German inflation hit almost 8% in August, and earlier this month, the Olaf Scholz government unveiled a new multi-billion euro relief package to help households cope with skyrocketing energy prices. On Monday, the IFO, Institute for Economic Research, predicted the German economy will fall into recession next year. IFO also warned that the first quarter of 2023 will be particularly rough for consumers, with inflation soaring to around 11%. Max Civili, Berlin.
As part of Israel's months-long so-called Operation Break the Wave, regime forces have arrested dozens of Palestinians during raids across the occupied West Bank since Sunday. This time, the regime intensified its arrest campaign in the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Israeli military issued a statement saying those who were detained are terrorist suspects. The regime conducts night raids in response to a series of anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of 19 Israeli soldiers and settlers earlier this year.
Whatever the Israeli military names its operations, these raids by the Israeli forces as well as by the settlers are an open war against the Palestinian people. The raids are an attempt to break the Palestinians' will to force them to abandon all forms of resistance and to stop fighting for their freedom.
The arrest campaign comes amid aggressive policies practiced by the Israeli prison authorities against thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing behind Israeli bars. Cancer-stricken prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah, is in a life-threatening health condition after he fell into a coma. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned Abu Hamid is fighting for his life as the Israeli prison service continues to refuse to provide him with necessary medical care. Abu Hamid has been in jail since 2002, serving a life sentence.
We call on all Palestinian groups to mobilize people and hold rallies to express their anger and rejection of the Israeli criminal policies that have led to the deaths of many of Palestinian prisoners. Nasser Abu Hamid is a national hero and a symbol for the Palestinian people. He is literally battling for his life due to his worsening health condition.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, 231 prisoners have died in Israeli jails since 1967. So on the one hand, detention of Palestinians is on the rise. And on the other hand, torturing and denying prisoners basic human rights is also on the rise. Israel claims these policies are meant to mow the lawn, prevent any forms of resistance. But for Palestinians, these illegal policies are part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against them. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Public expressions of grief for the death of the Queen by those who see the royals as a glamorous family contributing millions of dollars into the UK economy each year, for instance, in tourism revenues. But that sentiment seems to be changing with growing calls for Britain to become a republic. The reasons for that transformation vary, but one argument used on both sides of the divide is money, taxpayer money, more than $130 million of it, granted by the British government to the royal family, covering their official parties, travels, security, and upkeep of their palaces, funds that anti-monarchists say could be spent on more urgent matters.
So why, for a family that already has so many riches, why don't they pay for that? You know, why does that come out of the public pocket? Because especially in this time where we need public funds for the cost of living crisis, I mean, we've got so many underfunded public services here.
I don't think it sets a good precedent for the way, like, taxpayers' money is spent. Give it to the NHS.
The National Public Service is not the only area that needs help. There's the deepening cost of living crisis, driven by soaring energy costs and an economy on the brink of recession.
People are going to suffer fuel poverty over this winter, and that without intervention of a fairly drastic nature, people are going to have to decide whether to heat their homes or to eat. Now, this seems a total obscenity in a nation which is one of the G6.
The British monarchy has an estimated wealth of more than $90 billion and privileges not available to the rest of the public.
We have Prince Charles, who is about to inherit the world's wealthiest woman's entire portfolio without an inheritance tax. That is a loss of literally hundreds of millions to the exchequer.
The past few months have seen multiple public sector strikes, mostly overpay, to keep up with the soaring cost of living that's pushing millions of people into poverty. It remains to be seen if the House of Windsor will continue to live on the public dime, and if so, what will the public do about it? Cyprus is up, London.
After 1 year under the Taliban control, Afghanistan is on the brink of economic collapse. This is according to the latest update by the World Food Programme. The UN body says the economic crisis wiped out jobs, salaries, and livelihoods across Afghanistan, limiting people's purchasing power. The WFP has called on the international community to step up its efforts before winter to avert a humanitarian catastrophe.
Today, I came to the bazaar to buy some food. As I checked the prices and the money in my pocket, I couldn't afford a sack of rice. I'm sure others are facing the same situation. We call on the Taliban and the international community to take steps towards fixing Afghanistan's worsening economy.
Here on a Kabul street, Afghans sell household items to escape poverty and keep food on the plate. These people say it's a matter of survival for them. They are also concerned about their future.
We are just trying to survive in this difficult economic situation. We are forced to sell our belongings and household items to put bread on the table. Some are selling second-hand items to pay their debt and bills, since they have been unemployed for months. I don't know what I will do in the coming month to make ends meet.
The Taliban Deputy Economy Minister blamed the economic crisis on 2 decades of U.S. occupation and Washington sanctions on the war-ravaged country.
Today's deteriorating economic situation in our country is a legacy of the U.S. invasion, because the U.S. never let Afghan national economic bodies grow or become self-sufficient. All the U.S. did was to keep Afghanistan a consumer country and dependent on U.S. aid. Likewise, after the withdrawal, the U.S. seized Afghanistan's assets and cut international funding. As a result, the U.S. is to blame for Afghanistan's fragile economy.
In the meantime, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has announced that 25 million people in Afghanistan are living in poverty, and 19 million people are facing food insecurity. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The passing away of Queen Elizabeth II may be a sad day for a lot of people, especially in the UK, but at the same time, there are many who do not think about the Queen in positive terms. Some examples: the massacre in Northern Ireland, chemical attack by British forces in Iraq, the role it played in a coup against Iran's Mossadegh government. Well, those are just some of the things that happened during her watch over the UK. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will review some of the atrocities committed by the UK while the Queen resided at her palace and ask, was her role really ceremonial? And isn't it time to abolish the monarchy? A question that many are asking at this point. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Tehran, Arya Barzan Mohammadi, joins us. And we have Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute at the London Metropolitan University, George Zamir Yeli, who joins us from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. George, let me first start with you. We are taking a look at the headlines on mainstream media that are mourning the Queen pretty much nonstop from the time this occurred. And, of course, now Charles' accession to power. But then there are those that are calling for abolish the monarchy, which is a hashtag that's now trending loudly on social media. What are your thoughts on that aspect of the news about the Queen's death and, of course, Charles ascending to the throne?
Well, I don't think, to be honest, that there would be much change in British foreign policy were the monarchy abolished. I don't think the Queen ever really had much of a say in governmental policy. In fact, the Queen, even in realms where she might have had a say, an influence, for instance, in the Church of England. I mean, she's the head of the Church of England. She really, you know, took a hands-off approach. She was very much a ceremonial monarch, very popular for being so. But in terms of the foreign policy and all of the objectionable aspects of British foreign policy during her lengthy reign, and you mentioned a few of them, she really didn't make those decisions. And therefore, you know, whether under King Charles or a republic, and you know, all governmental decisions made by Prime Minister Liz Truss, I don't think there would be a huge difference in policy.
Well, there are some calls, however, that are being made to that effect, but more so, and maybe worth mentioning in a sense, if you can tell us what you recall, Mr. Muhammad, about some of the atrocities or conflicts, perhaps, that happened during her watch. There's a list of them, some of them that perhaps stand out as you had the Iraq and Syria, where Operation Shader took place from the year 2014. You have the Persian Gulf War, the Sierra Leone Civil War. I'm looking down a list here, the Suez Crisis. Of course, the Iraq War, Yemen, and Afghanistan wars worth also mentioning. Is it correct to see these as being what she oversaw and could have done something about, or completely detached from these occurrences during the time that she obviously was alive?
Well, I agree with your other guest that Queen's authority is very much ceremonial on the paper. However, we mustn't forget that she used to meet with Prime Minister on a weekly basis and provide advices. That's one thing, how she could have had some influence on decision making. And also, what we didn't see, or what she should have done, is to express her disagreement with some of the atrocities that you have mentioned, you know, loudly and publicly. I mean, I couldn't understand. I mean, what, for example, what happened in Kenya just maybe days after she took the throne, she became the queen, and the atrocities against the Mau Mau movement in that country. I mean, according to the New York Times, the response by the colonial authorities over there led to the establishment of vast system of detention camps and torture, abuse and killings, or killing of tens of thousands of people. And even the British government eventually agreed to pay £20 million in lawsuit compensation to the survivors of that atrocities. So in response or in answering your question, yes, the Queen enjoyed only ceremonial powers, but as a human being, she should have done more to at least detach herself from some of the atrocities that her governments have committed, from the coup against the Mossadegh to what happened in Kenya, to the apartheid regime in South Africa, the exercises, the acts against human rights over there. And you can mention many others. And not only that, we shouldn't forget the legacy, the historical legacy of the British Empire. So we shouldn't just look at her reign from 1952, but we should go further or back to the history, look back to the history and see what kind of atrocities and the crimes that the British Empire committed from the times of King George II,
sure,
to the times of Elizabeth II.
Well, Joyce Amoyeli, we're looking at what our guests said here about Mau Mau, and this happened right after her father's death. So you have her then take over the throne, and you have what our guests there referred to as a source in terms of how he explained it, and that was the New York Times, leading to the establishment of a vast system of detention camps, as our guest there quoted the New York Times torture, rape, castration, and the killing of tens of thousands of people. Since that was right after her father's death and when she took over the throne, could she not have then played a role in preventing from that happening then?
I doubt it. I think that had she interfered in any aspect of British policy, whether in foreign affairs or in domestic affairs, it would have led to the swift demise of the monarchy. At least, you know, she would definitely have believed that that was the case. I mean, the British worked out a formula for what they called a constitutional monarchy, even though Great Britain actually doesn't have a written constitution. It's a constitutional monarchy, which means that the monarch is essentially a non-political person, doesn't in any way interfere in any aspect of governmental policy. I mean, you know, the governments are formed, they go to the Queen establishes the government, and then, you know, when governments are closed down shop, you know, they go and tell the Queen that that's it, the government is dissolved. That's her role. If she were to start saying, well, I don't like this policy and I don't like that policy, it would have brought about a constitutional crisis and would have led to the demise of the monarchy. And I think she saw her role as someone who wants the monarchy to continue. She, you know, she wants to be the person who inherited the crown from her father and who will then pass the crown on to her son. Uh-huh. And doubtless Charles thinks that he's going to pass the crown on to his son. I mean, that's the way the system works. You can't really expect them to operate according to rules that you may like, but they obviously don't identify with.
Sure. Well, here's the problem that many see. And maybe you could shed more light on this or explain this to us, Mr. Mohammed. And that is the fact that, according to the way our guest describes it, if this was a one-off or maybe something that occurred twice during her 70 years when she had the throne, it could be dismissed as such, perhaps. And many may maybe look at it in a different way, but there are many who are holding the monarchy, and in particular her, responsible, since this has occurred so many times. For example, one of the social media reactions: if the Queen had apologized for slavery, colonialism, and neo-colonialism, and urged the Crown to offer reparations for the millions of lives taken in their names, then perhaps I would do the human being thing, or the human thing, and feel bad. As a Kenyan, I feel nothing. This theater is absurd. There are many people who hold her responsible. Do you think then, therefore, that she, again, could have exerted some type of influence when you're having repeated acts that spell that are of this nature?
Of course. I mean, she was a human being, after all. I mean, let me disagree with your guest, with the professor, because just years ago, when you know, the voting for Brexit took place, everyone knew that Queen was against Brexit. So probably if she could have voted, she would have voted again for no Brexit or not exiting the European Union. So people in England knew about Queen's opinion regarding Brexit. And she must have expressed it in the closed circles, and then this has found its way to the newspapers and, you know, tabloids, etc., etc. So I don't see what was the problem with, you know, making her opinion known to the people regarding some of these, you know, atrocities that you are mentioning. And I understand the role of monarchy in a constitutional monarchy in Europe, but we shouldn't forget that these things are not, you know, issues of budget or appointing this minister or removing that minister or canceling this or that program. These are really, really severe, decisions with the severe consequences that, you know, one should have reacted to them and as a human being and had a moral responsibility to actually oppose them if she thought that these were, you know, against her moral stance or ethics, or agreed with them. So that's one thing. The other thing is that you know, the monarchy, if we look at it even as a ceremonial or in, you know, something that is written, not in a written constitution or in a constitutional monarchy, if we look at other countries such as Scandinavian monarchies, we see some sort of a socialist monarchy. We don't see the same luxurious expending and the lifestyle that we see in British monarchy. And also they have less of you know, controversies from now and then. We know that the controversy surrounding the issues regarding Prince Andrew and other things. British people, many of them would you know, demand more clarity and more responsiveness regarding, you know, taxpayers' money being spent on luxurious weddings or ceremonies or lifestyles, while at the moment, you know, people are struggling with their fuel with providing fuel for their cars and paying for their electricity bills. This is not to say that, you know, we are going to say to the British people what system they should choose for themselves. This is up to the British people. But we shouldn't forget that the British monarchy's legacy is not exclusive to Britain. It goes beyond that. And currently, King Charles III, he has a lot of challenges to deal with. Namely, first of all, a second referendum, Scottish independence referendum is on the table. So we might see a potential breakup of the United Kingdom, mm-hmm. the unraveling of the Commonwealth, and reckoning with the unsavory past, parts of the royal family's past and its colonial legacy. So we have to see what kind of King Charles III would be. Is he going to remain silent on most of these issues or quiet, or he will decide to speak up and try to apologize to people of India, people in Africa, and other Commonwealth and other former colonies?
George Samioli, one of the questions that has been asked, and perhaps you can clarify for us or explain to us what the real reason is, and that is why the Queen never visited Israel. I mean, you read one source that says because the Queen did not like what Israel did in the occupied territories in terms of, the violation of Palestinians as a whole. Others say it's because of trade deals with the Persian Gulf Arab countries, didn't want to upset them. But many sources are pointing towards the violations of Palestinians, which then doesn't fall in line with the rest of the violations that took place on different countries that were part of the colonialism that the UK exercised.
That's a very good question, and it's it may be all of those things. She also probably has it's a sore point with her about the terrorism that took place during the time of the British occupation of Palestine, during the time of the Mandate, when Israeli terrorists, well, they weren't Israeli then, but the Stern Gang actually were murdering British officials. And that may well be a sore point with her. I don't know. It definitely is odd, but it wouldn't surprise me if there was some issue that that she feels strongly about what happened during the years of the British Mandate in Palestine.
Okay. Well, you talked about Prince Charles there, Arya Barzal Mohammed. There's a social media again reaction to him taking over the throne, and that is why should there even be a throne for him to take over? What is going to be the purpose? I mean, does that serve the 21st century type of governance that should exist? You know, those questions are resurfacing, especially right now. So isn't that a valid point of view for many to have, especially at this point in time where the UK, like many other European countries, but the UK is suffering economically so badly that many would question why should taxpayers' money go towards whatever it is that he's going to be doing?
It's not a secret to anyone that King Charles III doesn't enjoy the same popularity that his mother enjoyed inside the UK, at least. I mean, her mother, no matter what opinion the world has about her, was very popular inside the UK, or at least in England, if we exclude Scotland and Ireland. But Prince Charles doesn't enjoy even the same popularity inside England. And the reason, part of that is because of the story of Diana and the divorce and the family matters, private matters. And other part is that he is very, his style is very politically active style. So he likes to talk, when he was Prince of Wales, the Crown Prince, he usually commented about politics, about, what type of ministers should a certain prime minister choose, or what type of policies is preferable. So he was very talkative about it. And one of the famous sentences that he mentioned was after the return of Hong Kong to China, when he joked with it and called it a Chinese takeaway, which made the Chinese government very angry with that comment. So his activism might create some sort of controversy for him. It either could make him more popular if his activism is on the side of the people, if he decide to cut some of the budgets that for luxury spending and lifestyle, and try to treat members of his family, especially his brother, like any other person from the public, or his activism might become a source of a problem for him, especially with regard to issues such as Scottish referendum. Countries like Australia might choose to break away from, not the Commonwealth, but to choose another system for themselves instead of, monarchy, and choose the common republic. So there are a lot of issues that might resurface during King Charles' reign, while there was an agreement that there should keep kept quiet during her mother's reign, because of the prestige, international prestige that she enjoyed, and King Charles III so far doesn't enjoy it.
Thank you for that. Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University, George Samueli from Budapest. And thank you, Arya Barzan Mohammadi, Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies, University of Tehran. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of our weekly series, Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to mankind, the Holy Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In our last program in this series, we completed the explanation of Surah Hadid, and from this Friday onwards, we embark on explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Al-Mujadila, or the Pleader, which is number 58 in the serial order of compilation of the Holy Quran. It has 22 ayahs and was revealed in Medina. It mentions the complaint of a woman whose husband had put her away for no good reason for resorting to the pagan Arab formula known as zihar, which consists of the words, "You are to me as the back of my mother." This was a pagan custom to imply a kind of divorce that freed the husband from any responsibility for conjugal duties as well as providing support for children without allowing the wife the freedom to leave the husband's home or to contract a second marriage. The woman, who along with her husband had become a Muslim, pleaded to the Holy Prophet against this unjust behavior and said that she also lacked the means to support her little children. Her prayer to Allah and her plea was accepted, and this brutal and unjust custom of the pagan Arabs was abolished through revelation of this surah in the Holy Quran, which goes on to state that those who oppose God and the Prophet, or fall to the temptations of Satan, or lie in the oaths and make intrigue against the Prophet, will be defeated and suffer humiliation, both in this world and in the hereafter. While Hezbollah, or the Party of God, which means those who have firm faith in God, will triumph. The penalty prescribed for the husband who repents his act is to set a slave free, or fast for 3 months, and if not, to feed 60 destitute persons. Then only he can claim his conjugal rights. Such penalties were instrumental in the abolition of slavery in a rational and evolutionary way without creating chaos and disorder in society, in addition to providing welfare for the needy. As for the merits of reciting this surah, a narration from the Holy Prophet reads, "Whoever recites Surah Hadid and Surah Mujadila and reflects and acts upon them will be regarded as a member of Hezbollah, or the Party of God." Now let us listen to ayahs 1 and 2 of Surah Mujadila.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qad sami'a Allahu qawla allati tujadiluka fi zawjiha wa tashtaki ila Allahi wallahu yasma'u tahawurakuma. Inna Allaha sami'un basir. الذين يظاهرون منكم من نسائهم ما هن أمهاتهم إن أمهاتهم إلا اللائي ولدنهم وإنهم ليقولون منكرا من القول وزورا وَإِنَّ اللَّهَ لَعَفُوٌّ غَفُورٌ.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Allah has certainly heard the speech of her who pleads with you about her husband and complains to Allah. Allah hears the conversation between the two of you. Indeed, Allah is all-hearing, all-seeing. As for those of you who repudiate their wives by zihar, they are not their mothers. Their mothers are only those who bore them, and indeed, they utter an outrageous utterance and a lie. And indeed, Allah is all-excusing, all-forgiving. These ayahs negate the unjust and irrational pagan Arab practice of zihar, which we have already explained, and denounce those who, in spite of becoming Muslim, still cling on to such customs, which are indeed lies and outrageous utterances, and for the forgiveness of which the husbands are required to pay certain penalties. It is worth noting that ayah 1 refers 3 times to the power of hearing of the unseen but omnipresent Creator, who listens to whatever we say and is even aware of the thoughts that flash across our minds. Therefore, we should avoid lies and evil utterances and instead supplicate to God to answer our prayers. The next ayah clearly says that those who tell their wives, "You are like my mother to me," utter a falsehood, since the mother is the one who gives birth, which means being a mother or a child depends neither on words nor sophistry, but it is an indisputable biological reality. In other words, if a husband were to say even 100 times to his wife that she is a mother to him, it is nothing but falsehood, for which he should repent and seek forgiveness from the Almighty Creator. From these ayahs we learn that 1. The Holy Prophet of Islam was always accessible to all the people who could, without any restrictions, approach him for their needs or seek clarification of issues which were not clear to them. 2. The oppressive and irrational customs of pre-Islamic Arabia against women were either cancelled or corrected by Islam. 3. The Almighty Creator is well aware of all family issues as well as social relations, and has accordingly decreed just and fair laws. 4. Husband and wife should not indulge in evil behavior towards each other, since abusive words have negative impact on family life, including the tender psychology of children. Let us now listen to ayahs 3 and 4 of Surah Mujadala of the Holy Quran.
وَالَّذِينَ يُظَاهِرُونَ مِن نِّسَائِهِمْ ثُمَّ يَعُودُونَ لِمَا قَالُوا فَتَحْرِيرُ رَقَبَةٍ مِّن قَبْلِ أَن يَتَمَاسَّا. ذلكم توعظون به والله بما تعملون خبير. فمن لم يجد فصيام شهرين متتابعين من قبل أن يتماسا, فمن لم يستطع فإطعام 60 مسكينا. ذلك لتؤمنوا بالله ورسوله, وتلك حدود الله, وللكافرين عذاب أليم.
And those who repudiate their wives by zihar and then retract from what they have said shall set free a slave before they may touch each other. This you are advised to carry out, and Allah is well aware of what you do.
He who cannot afford to free a slave shall fast for 2 successive months, before they, husband and wife, may touch each other. If he cannot do so, he shall feed 60 destitute persons. This is in order that you may have faith in Allah and His Prophet. These are Allah's bounds, and there is a painful punishment for the faithless. Here it is stressed that merely by uttering zihar, a husband cannot divorce his wife, and the one who utters such a phrase should retract his words and pay the penalties stipulated in these ayahs for irresponsible behavior before resuming the conjugal relationship. These penalties are to strengthen one's faith in God and the Prophet, and refusal to observe these divine injunctions is an indication of disbelief for which there is painful punishment in afterlife. In other words, compensation for sins through expiation strengthens the pillars of faith and makes a Muslim practically committed to observance of divine laws. These ayahs teach us the following points. 1. Islam negates irrational customs and superstitions that are indeed a form of oppression in society, and prescribes penalties for those who indulge in such abominable behavior. 2. It is not lawful to utter absurd and abusive words. 3. Islam has used every opportunity to set slaves free, so that this tyrannical habit of holding fellow human beings in bondage is eradicated. And 4. Expiation and fines are stipulated in various forms to remove social injustice and to help the poor and the needy. And to conclude this week's program, here are ayahs 5 and 6 of Surah Mujadala of the Holy Quran.
إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يُحَادُّونَ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ كُبِتُوا كَمَا كُبِتَ الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِهِمْ وَقَدْ أَنزَلْنَا آيَاتٍ بَيِّنَاتٍ وَلِلْكَافِرِينَ عَذَابٌ مُهِينٌ يَوْمَ يَبْعَثُهُمُ اللَّهُ جَمِيعًا فَيُنَبِّئُهُم بِمَا عَمِلُوا أَحْصَاهُ اللَّهُ وَنَسُوهُ وَاللَّهُ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ شَهِيدٌ.
Indeed, those who oppose Allah and His Prophet will be subdued just as were subdued those before them. And we have certainly sent down manifest signs, and there is a humiliating punishment for the faithless. The day when Allah will raise them all together, He will inform them about what they have done. Allah has kept account of it, while they forgot it, and Allah is witness to all things. These ayahs mean to say that refusal to observe divine laws is tantamount to opposing God and the Holy Prophet, and such persons will meet the fate of the disobedient generations of the past. God Almighty has sent down manifest signs for the guidance of mankind, and for the faithless the punishment is terrible. That is, chastisement in the transient life of the mortal world, and for those who do not repent and reform themselves, the torment in afterlife is more severe. On the day of resurrection, when all people will be raised to life for the final judgment, God will inform the defaulters of what they used to do, even if they have forgotten their words, their deeds and actions, which are all minutely recorded in the divine register. The Almighty Creator is the witness of
everything. These ayahs teach us that, 1. Any opposition and obstruction to divine commandments will result in misery for man, both in this world and in the hereafter. And 2. Those belying the prophets are actually belying God and are thus doomed. And 3. On the day of judgment, the disbelievers and sinners will be given the record of their misdeeds to see themselves before being punished.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.